Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about Perelandra by C.S. Lewis, carrying on now with the second novel of the Ransom trilogy. So I'm pleased to be once again joined by Nick to continue the good work.
Good to be back. Obvious,
yeah, you were here for Out of the Silent Planet and people really enjoyed that, so it's wonderful to have you back, Nick.
Oh, it's good to be here. Yeah, that was a while ago because there was illness, there was tube strikes, it was annoying, the delays.
God, there was tube strikes, yeah, wasn't there? Yeah,
just... We were meant to do this ages ago, but it'll still be good. It just, I read them all, I was like, let's do them. Yeah. There's been a slight delay, but hopefully worth doing, because this is a great book, and it's even better, most people would say, than Out of the Silent Planet.
I would agree with this. I would agree with this. One of the things that I loved so much about Out of the Silent Planet was the fact that C.S. Lewis entirely surprised me, because I entirely bought into Ransom's expectations of what he would find on Malacandra, which, you know, just a planet of alien life and danger and death. And it wasn't like that at all. What you find from Out of the Silent Planet is that Earth is the outlier. Earth is the strange one in all of this. Earth is the silent planet. And the reason it's silent is because it's cut off from the heavens. It's cut off from the Field of Arbol, as it's termed in this, where you can hear and have communion with God, with Mereldil, much more honestly, because it's being corrupted by the devil, the bent one, mm-hmm. from the beginning of the fall. Mm-hmm. And this obviously comes down to Perelandra. And so one of the things that I loved so much about it was that after reading the first novel, I expected Ransom to come to this new planet, would be introduced to all these different types of alien races again, but they'd be different but the same. And it's not that at all. And because of the way that Lewis writes it, the stakes in this story are so much higher than anything in the first novel.
Yeah, it's very different. It's less conventional sci-fi. Not that the last one was that conventional, but it's less conventional, and it moves into the theological and the imaginative. Lewis himself, in an essay about the six subspecies of sci-fi, talks about the change he made. He said, I once took a character to Mars in a spaceship, but then I realized it was much better to take them to Venus via an angel. So he doesn't even bother with spaceships anymore. He's in some new realm here.
Yes.
Because there's all these different types of science fiction. He's very against the displaced person, which he says is just a domestic story, like a love story, and you just moved it to another planet. He thinks that's rubbish.
Right, I see.
And then he goes to like engineer sci-fi, where he's like, maybe good, but I'm not an expert. He doesn't really have an opinion, which is like Jules Verne or something. Things how they might actually work, how you might actually get under the sea or to the moon or something. He's much more in this imaginative tradition, which Perelandra falls under. So it's not that conventional sci-fi. I'd be almost recommend it to someone who loves science fiction. They may or may not like it, but if they like great writing and great novels, they will love it. And it was Tolkien's favourite, and I believe his daughter's favourite. So
interesting.
Good taste.
Yeah. Well, I can certainly see why. So it picks up very organically. So we start the story with Lewis, Oxford scholar and friend of the protagonist of the first novel, Elwyn Ransom. And it begins with him on a walk along the country road after getting to, Worcester train station, because he's going to go to meet Ransom, because Ransom has asked if he can pop up for the weekend to discuss business. And Lewis knows exactly what this means. He means it's going to have to be something relating to Ransom's experiences up on Malacandra and this sort of high destiny that now surrounds him as a result of meeting the Oyasa, meeting something that's essentially like the guardian of Mars. one of the things that I love so much about this original first chapter is the fact that you really get into Lewis's head and you get inside of the head of a character who hasn't experienced what Ransom has experienced out there. In fact, only a few very, very trusted friends Ransom has actually told about what happened up there, of course, because you go talking to the press, you'd immediately look like a loony, right, and no one would believe you.
Yeah, so Lewis comes in at the very end of Out of the Silent Planet as a character, doesn't he? And he's here more as a character because he's actually moving around in the action now.
Yeah.
In the end of that, he's really just in communication with Ransom via letters. Something strikes me, maybe this is an inconsistency, I need to check this, but doesn't he say at the end of Out of the Silent Planet that Ransom is a shooting him? But then,
yes, he does.
But then in this book, there's a part where it says, you know, you're called Ransom for a reason.
Yeah,
so that might be an inconsistency. Knowing Lewis, that might just be a mistake because he's known for doing those because he was so prolific.
Yes.
And unlike Tolkien, he wasn't that meticulous about it.
Yeah, there was another moment actually really early on where I thought, is that something of a retcon?
Which
is where Ransom is explaining to Lewis that he's going to get sent on to Perelandra now on the orders of the Oyasa. So he's going to go to Venus. And he talks about the fact that it's like, oh, well, I speak old Solar, and so this will be fine. And Lewis says to him, but I thought that that was the language of Malakandra. It's like, well, yes, it was one of them. It's the oldest of those languages, but the other two and you're like, okay, this is a bit, like, right, you know, like, just basically so that Ransom doesn't have to go through the process of learning a new language again in the story.
Yeah. He was already... Yeah, you can allow these little things. He was already suspiciously good in the last one, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, he's a philologist, but like he was immediately communicating with this bizarre language.
With the Fiffle Triggy.
and the Hrosser. It's like, you seem pretty good at this language, yeah. Because that kind of thing will ruin it if you get too hung up on those sort of things.
Yeah.
And Lewis, you know, he started Narnia not really thinking it was going to be a series or anything. I think he initially threw it in the bin and someone said,
really?
His friend said, no, this is actually good. Because Tolkien didn't like them, you know, in the meetings. And so then he obviously ends up doing seven of them, but he had to make up some of that as it went along. And he made up Magician's Nephew later, which is a kind of prequel to Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. But Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe doesn't actually make sense if you think about Magician's Nephew, because then they already know Aslan, whereas they make it sound like they really don't know much about it.
When you say they, who do you?
Well, yeah, it's a bit tricky because the professor character already has been.
Oh, Diggory.
Yeah, has already been. And so... It's a bit like they talk about it. Everything's spoken about in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe like it's new, but they really already know about, you know, it's kind of questionable.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but Lewis, he was like this. He was the opposite of Tolkien. Tolkien's like, right, this all has to make sense, the entire histories. Lewis was like, oh, there's a fawn and there's Father Christmas. What do you want from me? You know? But I, you know, as I said, I actually prefer Lewis's fiction, which is sort of quasi-blasphemous. But anyway, I don't want to derail it. So, yeah, we start with Lewis as a character in this one, helping Ransom to get to Venus.
Before we get there, there's just one part where he's walking down this country road and already he doesn't really want to be there.
Right.
And he's saying to himself, oh, well, it's going to be, you know, I'm just so busy. There are other things that I could really be doing right now. And then as he just begins to scratch further and further down his conscience, it's like, no, you're afraid.
Yeah.
That's why you're actually, because you're afraid of being drawn in.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful extensive passage about how you just get drawn into things, whether it's a political party or a social club or whatever it may be. And just that apprehension that is our nature as human beings to just take the first step that drags you into something where all of a sudden you're like, right, this is what I have to do now. Now that I've committed to it, that first step, I have to see this through. And this is what Lewis is really anxious about. He's anxious about now this suddenly being, because of his friendship with Ransom, a life commitment that he's also going to have to hold himself to.
Yeah, and beyond that, I believe he's actually demonically attacked on the way, the implication is.
Little does he know it at the time.
Because Ransom basically says, didn't you feel that or something? And he's like, oh, right. So he's getting all these different voices.
Yeah, I thought I was just being...
negative.
Yeah, but it's like, no, you were under attack from dark forces.
Yeah.
And so Lewis goes to Ransom's house after he's left his bag on the train. It's already at the start of a terrible weekend. And they get into the house, and this is where it's all pitch black. Ransom's not home yet. He's left a note saying that he had to go and do something at Cambridge and he'll be back later in the evening. And this is where, as Lewis is fumbling out in the dark, he happens upon the Oyasa of Mars.
Right.
Just there in the room.
Yeah.
And he has this first encounter mm-hmm. with something that is unfathomable to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, genuine comes from, so, is so ancient and is, you know, and as the Oyasa said to Ransom back at the end of the first one, it's like, well, I'm not here in the same way that you are here. Mm. And even though there is a voice, but as we find out
and
later,
sort of a
well,
light, a vague light.
Yeah, and a vague light. And so everything, it just comes across as somewhat gothic and really supernatural. And you just buy into Lewis's anxieties about all of this. But obviously once Ransom comes back, Ransom's perfectly chipper and just begins to explain things very methodically to him. And it's really interesting just at the beginning here because Ransom grows so much over the course of this novel, but it's self-evident just from the moment that he's introduced here how much his experiences in the first novel also changed him as well. You know, because he started out as someone who was just accidentally brought to Mars by Weston and Devine. And then as a result of that, encountered the divine and became in touch with the Field of Arbol and Mereldil's will, even though he was already a Christian, but in ways that he could never have even conceived of. Whereas now you see him as someone dedicated to this task that has been given. The Oyasa has told him, I need you to go to Venus, to Perelandra, on a mission. Ransom has no idea what this is. He doesn't actually have any inkling as to what is expected of him, but he's still going to do it, and he's going to put his faith in whatever the divine decree is that has been laid out before him.
Yeah, he was a total everyman, naive at the start of the first one. I suppose he has grown. He's sort of more of a heroic character by this stage, and it'd have to be for the tasks he has to do in this.
Yes.
And then by the third one, which one we may get onto, he's become a completely different character again, to the point where Lewis has to introduce a new everyman character as the protagonist. So, because it wouldn't work anymore. But so in this, I'd say he's somewhat between an everyman and heroic. He still has a new challenge, but he's not completely green like he was in the first one.
No, and what he needs of Lewis, the reason for Lewis needing to come up on business, is he says that, well, I'm going to be sent away in this magical flying coffin that's being prepared for me.
Which is an interesting choice, isn't it? I mean, is it about resurrection? The choice of the coffin is quite interesting. I didn't totally decide on what the symbolism of it was, really. There's different ideas, but...
Yeah, it's very enigmatic.
Yeah.
And it doesn't... because there are many things in here where if there is a slight chance of ambiguity, especially when we get into later on where we go into the really rich philosophical and theological conversations, Lewis does a very good job of just keeping the guard railings there so you understand exactly what the point he's trying to make is and exactly what he means. But in terms of some of the more visual aspects of this novel, yeah, there's definitely a room for metaphor.
An analogy with Christ, the fact that he goes in his coffin and then comes out of it and is sort of in a sense resurrected?
Born
they think
again.
He's dead. I wonder, not sure, but it's an interesting method of... he was less concerned with all the trouble of the spaceship. He just like, stick him in the coffin, we'll transport
naked.
Him. Naked.
And so he just says to him, look, I'm going to be going away. I don't know how long, but get me a doctor just for in case I need one when I get back. And so Ransom gets into the coffin and the Oyasa whisks him away to Perelandra. And as opposed to following Ransom, we actually stay with Lewis and the Doctor Humphreys, who is just enlisted as well to help with this. And a year later, Ransom returns and comes out of the coffin again. And he's covered in all of these, obviously alien flowers. And once again, he's totally naked. But unlike when he left, Lewis remarks on the fact that he looks 10 years younger.
Yeah.
Remarkably more buff, and you know, Ransom's jacked all of a sudden,
but with an injury to his heel.
To his heel, yes, which just keeps hemorrhaging. Mm-hmm. It will not stop bleeding. And that was very interesting. So you're left with these puzzle pieces as you see the changed man. And then we go back to Ransom's account and we figure out how all of this came to be.
Yes, and the heel, I don't know if we want to talk about it now or later, but it probably pertains to Genesis 3:15. I may as well say it now. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy heel, and thou shalt bruise his heel. But it also mirrors the mythological Fisher King from Celtic legend, representing a sacred sacrificial wounding linked to the health of a realm. Mm. So it's a sort of sacrificial wound with possible biblical, pagan connotations.
For the realm of Perelandra.
Yeah.
That he put himself in the way, for that. And so he comes to Perelandra. And once again, it's a fantastic way that Lewis immediately provides you something entirely new. Because whereas on Malacandra, you have these great dipping canyons and gorges and like vast high mountains, and it being a place of hard rock and, you know, solid land, what we get here is the total opposite of that. We get something like a water world, like Kamino in Attack of the Clones. And in fact, I've got a description of it here.
Let me just say why you're doing that. Lewis, just happened to have heard an essay on this recently, in his science fiction essay. He said he thinks he already knew by the time he wrote that there were telescopes that could show there weren't canals on Mars, but he wasn't too bothered. So I had a friend who said he struggled with these books because we already know the heavens wasn't like that. You know, we know now, the planets aren't, as Lewis said. It's like, I never thought that's really a problem.
No,
it's not, we don't have to be too little.
Yeah.
Lewis wasn't even bothered at the time. Okay, Mars isn't like this, so what?
Yeah.
But anyway.
Story is like this.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a story.
And Perelandra, as you say, very different. So yeah, go ahead with the description.
It says, his first impression was of nothing more definite than of something slanted, as though he was looking at a photograph which had been taken when the camera was not held level. And even this lasted only for an instant. The slant was replaced by a different slant. Then two slants rushed together and made a peak, and the peak flattened suddenly into a horizontal line, and the horizontal line tilted and became the edge of a vast gleaming slope which rushed furiously towards him. At the same moment, he felt that he was being lifted up and up. He soared till it seemed as if he must reach the burning dome of gold that hung above him instead of the sky. And I'll just fast forward a bit where it says, there was no land in sight. The sky was pure flat gold, like the background of a medieval picture. It looked very distant, as far off as a circus cloud looks from Earth. The ocean was gold too, in the offing, flecked with innumerable shadows. The nearer waves, though golden where their summits caught the light, were green on their slopes, first emerald, and lower down a lustrous bottle green, deepening to blue where they passed beneath the shadow of other waves. And just glorious imagery. I really love how he describes the environments and nature and all of the actual landscapes that he constantly puts Ransom into. And so you get this remarkable geology to Perelandra, where the entirety of its landmass is just covered by water. And there are pockets of land, but even these are not land as we would conceive of them. They're almost like joined together rafts of vegetation on which other land masses and plumage and wilderness thrive. But ultimately, these islands exist almost like I think he describes them almost as if like the core of the earth is a ball, as if there were other balls on top of it and they were just constantly rolling around on the top of the surface. Right. But there is one fixed land.
Yeah.
In the entire place, which we'll obviously explore a bit later.
Yeah, right, because that's very significant. Yeah, it's mainly floating islands with some fixed land. And I don't know if you were going to mention things like the fruits, but he talks at length about these extraordinary fruits and all the vegetation, and you can basically eat virtually everything in the place. And one thing I noted about the fruit was you never want to binge on it. I think it's the fruit he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a juice, it's like a gourd, or it's like a juice, whatever. He eats it. And it's so good, he thinks he'd want to do it again, but he doesn't. And that's because he's on Perelandra, where one doesn't have these impulses. You just have the right amount of appetite, the appropriate amount.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of the Hrossa in the first book, when we're talking about their attitude towards procreation, where they procreate and then that's it. they don't have any desire to like have endless sex. And Ransom was trying to understand that.
Yeah.
It's because they're unfallen. So in this unfallen state, you don't want to gorge yourself on food and be a glutton. You naturally only want to eat the appropriate amount. Yeah.
There's no temptation to have more than you need.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And also as well, the wildlife that's described around it as well. So you've got like these, I think he was like, yeah, there was this dragon.
There's immediately a small dragon.
Yeah.
And like, is that going to be a massive part of it? But not really.
No.
It's just there.
Yeah.
It's just one of the creatures.
So he describes it as being like the size of a border collie or something like that. Just like this dog-sized little dragon. And Ransom tries to speak to it in old Sola.
Right.
And he talks about the fact that it comes in peace and everything. And this dragon just follows him around for a little bit.
Right.
But there's just obviously these remarkable fish-like creatures in the sea as well. And Ransom begins to query. I mean, you get all sorts as well, animals in the caves, just a whole abundance of them. Obviously, the piebalds as well, which we'll address more when we're introduced to the lady. But you get all of these things, and Ransom begins to understand that because Perelandra is shielded from the Bent One, so far, it basically exists in a state where a lot of the pagan mythological creatures that mankind understood on Earth exist here in their actual perfected form.
Hmm.
And so there's this wonderful element to it where all of these mythological creatures that exist both in pagan myth and in the Bible. I mean, after all, you know, obviously the dragons are biblical creatures as well. I mean, obviously, I know that Satan turns into a dragon in Revelation, but you see all of these animals here that one time a day you'd have thought, well, it's just myth, it's not really anything. Actually, it's all true. In the same way that I suppose in Narnia, you encounter centaurs and mermaids and all these sorts of creatures as well. So it's an interesting parallel between the two.
Yeah, it is interesting. And the one comment I had about the whole start, you say how great the descriptions are. That whole first passage is brilliant to read, as are the dialogues with the Green Lady. You're in this paradise, and yet it's not boring. Because I may have said before, but there was this old quote from Henri de Motherlant, who said, "Happiness writes white." Martin Amis was fond of quoting it. The idea that it's very hard to write about happiness because it's nothing really goes on.
Mm.
Much easier to write about problems and drama. But Lewis does it so well at the start of this, you'd think it'd be boring describing it in Eden, essentially, but it isn't.
Well, one thing I'd just say is that what you were saying certainly seems to be true. And it even seems to be true, certainly, within the field of, you know, commentary and the stuff that we do. I mean, you and I both know well enough that negatively tilted storylines do far better and more people want to click on them than they ever do if you advertise that there's been some good news.
Yeah.
People do just seem a bit hardwired that way.
Yeah.
But the other thing as well is that, sorry, what was your second point?
I was saying that it's hard to write happiness and a paradise.
Yeah, sorry, that was it. But as you say, it's absolutely not boring because there is still so much mystery within the story.
Mm.
Ransom's here. Yeah, okay, fine. There seems to be no imminent threats against him. All of the animals are perfectly lax. Nothing's threatening him. There seems to be no immediate risk to his person. But why is he here?
What is
he doing here? Where are the other life forms that he's supposed to be interacting with as an ambassador from his own planet? Because he wanders vast, vast swathes of the planet. And there's these wonderful passages where it's just dedicated to him learning to walk
on
the land masses, on these rafts, as they're constantly going up and, you know, on top of different waves and everything. And him describing it as basically him having to learn to walk all over again.
Right.
It's like that. And so you get these ones of him just acclimatizing to the new location.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you end up meeting the Green Lady.
Right. And that's very mysterious as well, because she's waving at him and we know it's going to be important, but we don't know who she is. She's waving, very excited, and then she's very disappointed.
Yes. And I wanted to read this as well, because, again, it was just fantastic. Where it says, "Amidst all this, she stood looking at him, her feet together, her arms hanging at her side, her stare level and unafraid, communicating nothing. Ransom determined to speak, using the old solar tongue. "I am from another world," he began, and then stopped. The Green Lady had done something for which he was quite unprepared. She raised her arm and pointed at him, not as in menace, but as though inviting the other creatures to behold him. At the same moment, her face changed again, and for a second he thought that she was going to cry. Instead, she burst into laughter, peal upon peal of laughter, until her whole body shook with it, till she bent almost double, with her hands resting on her knees, still laughing and repeatedly pointing at him. The animals, like our own dogs in similar circumstances, dimly understood that there was merriment afoot, all manner of gamboling, wing-clapping, snorting, and standing upon hind legs began to be displayed. And still the Green Lady laughed, till yet again the waves divided them, and she was out of sight. Ransom was thunderstruck. Had the El Dealer sent him to meet an idiot, or an evil spirit that mocked him? Or was it, after all, an hallucination? For this was just how an hallucination might be expected to behave. So, very underwhelming for Ransom's first encounter.
Yes, and it turns out she finds him funny because he looks weird because parts of him, half of him is tanned by the sun and half isn't.
Mm.
And this is why she calls him Piebald, because he's a weird, patchy mixture.
Yes.
And generally his state looks funny to her. He's been through this journey. She hasn't seen anything like him.
Yeah.
She's used to perfect beings, not weird blokes.
He describes, doesn't he, when he's in the coffin, when he's being transported, even as he's in some sort of like stasis state, that half of his body is warm, is hot, and half of his body is cold. And then, yeah, as he comes out and he's got this very, very uneven suntan, you know, she just finds it immediately humorous. And she, of course, herself, apart from being all green, is also naked. And very importantly, apart from her greenness, she is actually human. Physically speaking, she looks human. She just looks like a green human.
Right.
And of course, this is something that totally catches Ransom off guard, given that he's just been on the planet of Sorns and Hrosses and Triffle Figgies, and now to find a new human here. And so eventually, as he tries to swim to her, the tide brings him back, and eventually they manage to communicate with one another again. And as you say, she explains to him that, well, she was laughing because of his appearance, and also that she now knows that he didn't like that laughter, and that now she is older because of it.
Yeah, he tries to figure out how, in what sense she's human, and it says, but this creature was not of his race.
Mm.
No windings, however intricate, of any genealogical tree could ever establish a connection between himself and her. In that sense, not one drop in her veins was human. The universe had produced her species and his quite independently. So she sort of is and isn't. She looks the same, but can't possibly be human in the same sense.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No.